The reading today is from the book of Leviticus, chapter 18, and it's on page 120 in the Church Bible. Reading from verse 1, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Speak to the Israelites and say to them, I am the Lord your God. You must not do as they do in Egypt, where you used to live, and you must not do as they do in the land of Canaan, where I am bringing you. Do not follow their practices. You must obey my laws and be careful to follow my decrees. I am the Lord your God. Keep my decrees and laws, for the person who obeys them will live by them. I am the Lord.'" And if you turn over the page to chapter 20 and going starting from verse 22. "Keep all my decrees and laws and follow them, so that the land where I am bringing you to live may not vomit you out. You must not live according to the customs of the nations I am going to drive out before you. Because they did all these things, I abhorred them. But I said to you, you will possess their land. I will give it to you as an inheritance, a land flowing with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God, who has set you apart from the nations. You must therefore make a distinction between clean and unclean animals and between unclean and clean birds. Do not defile yourselves by any animal or bird or anything that moves along the ground. For those that I have set apart as unclean for you, you are to be holy to me because I, the Lord, am holy. And I have set you apart from the nations to be my own." Amen.
Well, good morning, everyone. Good to be with you today. Thank you to Drew for the kind welcome. Yes, we do go back a long, long way. Lovely to be back with you. Just a personal word. Grateful to you for your prayers. It is such a massive blessing to belong to the people of God and have them pray for you. And I just want to say thank you to you for being that to me over the past year. But it's good to be here and good to feel not bad. If you've got a Bible, you need to open at Leviticus chapter 18. 18 to 24 is what I have been allotted to this morning. So you will appreciate that Leviticus is one of these books that just asks this massive question: where do you and I look to root our identity? Now, identity is not optional. We all have an identity. It may come from our past, or it may be something that we aspire to. We want to make our mark in a certain area of life. We want to have that sense of belonging, of being somebody. And so identity is massively important to us. Now, if you have a look at chapter 18 and verse 2, which David just read for us, the Bible tells you and I where we're not to root our identity. He says to Israel, don't look back to Egypt. I guess if you'd asked me, what do the Egyptians care about? Probably the answer is wealth. I mean, it's famous, is it not, for its treasures, its gold, its luxury. How did you become a success, or how were you assigned the title failure answer. Where you located yourself on that line of wealth. Don't look to Egypt. Don't look to Canaan. Canaan was about fertility. To be a success in Canaan, you had to have big herds, big flocks. Your wife had to produce lots of sons. And you needed to know the way into that prosperity was by means of your relationship with Baal, this idolatrous god. And here's God speaking to his people and saying to them that these are not the places to look for your identity. As they gather at the foot of Mount Sinai, and I think that's where the book of Leviticus fits in. They're maybe 6 months out of Egypt. There they are at the foot of this mountain. God speaks to them, gives them his law. But he also tells them who they are. You're not Egyptians. You're not Canaanites. You are my holy nation. Exodus 19. And it's easy for churches to pay lip service to that idea. But actually, when it comes to it, the people who we look up to and respect are those who are doing okay on the wealth line. Or those who are doing pretty well on the intelligence line. But when you enter this book of Leviticus, you find that the line that matters is not how much money you've got or how many qualifications you've got. The line that matters goes from defilement to holiness. The line is a line of cleanliness. Defilement, uncleanness, cleanness, holiness. That's the line that matters. Jesus operated on that line. You would have expected him to be a little more enlightened, wouldn't you? When the man suffering from leprosy comes to him and makes his request, you would expect Jesus to have said, "Be well, be healed." That would have been enlightened, do you not think? He doesn't say that. He says, "Be clean." He's operating on the Leviticus line. When he washes the disciples' feet on the eve of his execution, he says to Peter, "What I'm doing now you do not understand, but later you will understand." And in almost the next breath, he says, "And you are clean, but not every one of you." He's on the Leviticus line. The big message of this book comes in chapter 19 and verse 1. We didn't read the words, but you'll know the words. Be holy because I am holy. Now, you could hear that as, oh, that means keep the rules. Rules do not make people holy. That's what the Pharisees teach us. Jesus looks at the Pharisees and says, "Do you know what? You're like dirty cups. Outside, you look fine. Inside, you're grubby and dirty. You're like whitewashed tombs. Beautiful on the surface, but we all know what's under the ground. That's you." And Jesus is emphasizing for us that it's much more about the internal than it is about the external. Chapter 18 has got a great deal to say about sexual sin. If you read chapter 18 in the ESV, it doesn't use the phrase sexual relations. It uses the phrase uncover the nakedness. Now, what Jesus teaches us is you don't need to uncover someone's nakedness physically. You can do it in your head. You've heard it said, Do not commit adultery, but I say to you, anyone who looks lustfully at a woman has committed adultery in his heart. It's not external, but internal. Now, it doesn't mean that the commandments have no place. It doesn't mean they're redundant. It doesn't mean the laws don't matter. But someone has explained it like this. The commandments are like the steering wheel, but they don't provide the power. Or the other way to look at it is the commandments are the rails that we run on, but they're not the engine that drives us forward. Now, as Drew said when he referred earlier, that in chapter 19, you get that little phrase just punctuating the whole chapter all the way through, I am the Lord. I am the Lord. And you might notice in your Bible that it's always capitalized. Somebody's making a point here. I am the capitalized Lord. And when you see that, it's meant to take your mind back to Exodus chapter 3. Exodus chapter 3 is where Moses sees this bush that's on fire. Is that with these sheep? Thinks, oh, that's weird. That bush is on fire, but it doesn't seem to be burning up. And he goes to have a look, and then he has that conversation with God. And in the course of the conversation, he says to God, what is your name? And God says, my name is I am who I am, which is kind of summarizes this word Lord in our Bibles. Now, the first thing that strikes you about that is a pretty weird name. You say to me, what's your name? I say, my name's Kenny. You say to God, what's your name? And he says, I am who I am. In other words, First off, we're being told that God is not like, he's not just a bigger version of you and me. He's not just smarter, bigger, stronger. No. He's different. He is mysterious. He is other. He is distinct. And yet at the same time, this God who is I am, eternally I am, complete in himself, needs nothing, absolutely happy in himself, is announcing that he is coming to serve people. Why is he speaking to Moses? Because I'm coming to rescue you. The love of God is not the kind of love you meet in chapter 18, which is about self-indulgence, sexual indulgence. That goes under the name of love, but actually it's another four-letter word, isn't it? No. The love of God is not curved in on himself. The love of God is outward, other-sectored, sacrificial. I am who I am. But there's a third strand to this. He speaks to Moses. He announces to him that he's coming to serve. Why? Because he made a promise 400 years ago to give this land of Canaan to his people. So bound up in this word Lord, there is mysterious lordship, there is sacrificial love, and there is loyalty of an astonishing nature. Now that's just going to be the kind of little pattern we're going to try and follow through this morning. Got these three things in your head? This is who we're talking about. This is what we are engaging with. Here's what we are to be involved with. So here's number one. Holiness. We're trying to get our heads around holiness, okay? Holiness bows before the Lordship of God. Let me try and unpack that a little bit for you. So if you look at chapter 19 and verses 23 to 25, it's all about fruit trees. 3 years of harvest are forbidden. So your fruit tree grows, it's got a great crop of apples. No, forbidden. And in the fourth year, no, don't get excited yet, this is all going to God. Now, you may be an expert in fruit trees and you may know all about why you shouldn't be eaten in the first 3 years. No disrespect, I am not interested. Don't tell me at the end. God gives his people no explanation. It's just, don't eat the fruit. Echoes? You're thinking, I've heard that sort of stuff before? In the middle of the Garden of Eden, there is a tree, it's called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Don't eat the fruit. It's forbidden. Now, my point is this. There is no explanation added. It's just don't. God says to Abraham, take your son, your only son whom you love, and present him to me as a burnt offering. Abraham has two things going through his head. One is, through Isaac, your descendants will be reckoned. Okay, first thing he's got in his head, through Isaac, this miraculous child, your whole family will follow. And take Isaac and put him on an altar and offer him to me as a sacrifice. Now, my point is this. Abraham then doesn't spend the next 6 months trying to square the circle of that. Oh, how do these two things fit together? I wonder. No, he just goes and leaves the rest to God. John the Baptist, in his prison cell, sends Jesus a message. Are you the one who is to come, or should we look for someone else? And implicit in that statement there is, where's the fire of judgment? Why are you not chopping down trees? Why are you not dealing with this corrupt religion that's going on? Now, Jesus doesn't say to John the Baptist, John, let me explain to you. It's a slightly longer process than you thought. The kingdom's come, but it's not wholly here yet. I'm going to make two entrances, Bethlehem and at the end. No, none of that. Do you know what he says to John? Blessed are those who do not take offense because of me. That's enough. No explanation. John has to bow before the Lordship of Jesus. I've just been reading a very helpful book on Psalm 23, which is entitled The Lord of Psalm 23 by a guy called David Gibson. If you find it, it's an excellent book. David Gibson makes this little point in working his way through Psalm 23. You go to verse 3. What does David say in verse 3? He says, guide me in the right ways. Lead me in the paths of righteousness. Okay. Good prayer. What's the next verse? Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Oh. The paths of righteousness go down into the valley of the... Now, some of you have been in that place, and you know it's a terrible place. It's dark, it's difficult, it's hard. What explanation does David get? None. You see, God does not offer David an explanation. He offers him a companion. And when you get to verse 4 of Psalm 23, David stops talking about God. The Lord is my shepherd. He makes me lie down in green pastures. And he starts talking to God. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. That's what you get. So here's the first element of holiness. Sometimes the ways of the Lord will be inscrutable. You will not be able to work out what is going on. But there is companionship and there is support. Well, let's look at the second thing. Holiness reflects God's generous love. And we're going to mainly look at chapter 19 here. But let me just, before you get there, verse 24 in chapter 20, these people are the objects of God's generosity. But I have said to you, you shall inherit their land, and I will give it to you to possess, a land flowing with milk and honey. And if you read on in other parts, it's described as a land of brooks, streams, and deep springs gushing out. A land with wheat and barley, vines and fig trees. A land where bread will not be scarce and you will lack nothing. Just get this generosity of God kind of heaped on these people. There's nothing mean or measured about any of this. It's vast and rich because of the outpouring kindness of God to his people. Chapter 19 and verse 18 has that famous phrase, love your neighbor as yourself. Now, quite a lot of chapter 19 is expressed negatively. Don't do this, don't do that, don't do the next thing. When the Westminster Confession comments on the Ten Commandments, it says this, that the commandments ask the question, what are the duties required as well as what are the sins forbidden? You read the commands, it's stated negatively, but the implication is there's a positive side to it. So, chapter 19 and verse 9. Don't harvest your fields right to the edge. Leave the gleanings for the poor. Now, you probably know in another part of the Bible, it talks of this wealthy farmer, his name's Boaz, who doesn't just leave a bit of extra at the edge for the poor, but he tells his guys to start chucking down handfuls of grain in front of the poor people who are coming behind him. And when it comes to lunchtime, he invites the gleaner, Ruth, to share his lunch. And all because of who he believes God is, he says to Ruth, under his wings you have come to take refuge. That affects the way Boaz treats the poor. Or you look at verse 13, do not defraud or rob your neighbor. Now, it's not difficult to see what's forbidden there. But what's required? Your neighbor might be a family member. Lot, Abraham's nephew. When he gets the chance, first dibs at which bit of land he wants, and he chooses for himself. And yet when Lot finds that he's made a bad choice and he gets swept up in this invasion and abducted, Abram raises a force and goes and rescues him. That's the positive side. Or maybe your neighbor is a member of a rival family. David shows kindness to Mephibosheth, who belongs to the family of Saul, who spent his time trying to kill him. And he treated him as his own son and brought him to his table. Gave him a place amongst his family. I need to ask myself, what's my involvement with the poor? How do I relate to people who are selfish, like Lot? Who gets to sit at my table? Who eats my food? And then he mentions two groups of people, one of whom have been mentioned to us already by Drew, the elderly and the stranger. Stand up in the presence of the aged. Show respect for the elderly. It's not just in the customs of the Egyptians and the Canaanites that these people are not rated. But I think you'd say in our culture today, often the elderly are viewed as a burden. Love is defined as being patient and kind. It's not always easy to be patient and kind when you've been asked the same question 5 times. But it is good, and it is holy, and it is what God is calling us to. Or what if strangers, foreigners, in fact, politically they are not in a good place today in our culture. Yet the New Testament word for, you probably know this, hospitality is love of strangers. And our God is not only a God who welcomes strangers, but he welcomes enemies. That's why we are here today. Work out the implication in your life. Think about it. When it comes to generosity, God has given us a great deal more than a land flowing with milk and honey. He has blessed us with every spiritual blessing in Christ. He has poured out on us his grace and goodness. And as you value and process that, what is meant to flow out of our lives is this kind of generous love. One last thing, and with this we're finished. Okay. Holiness bows to God's lordship. Holiness follows the example of God's love. And holiness ultimately rests in his faithfulness. So here's the third strand. The Lord, the I Am. The one who needs nothing and is completely content and full of joy in himself comes to his people specifically and deliberately to keep his 400-year-old promise that he made to Abraham, to give them the land. Now, the thing that reminds us of this is the festival. So just flick over to chapter 23. So the little section we're looking at today goes mostly law, 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 and then you get to 23 and 24 and it goes into the kind of rhythm of life. Okay. How's the year meant to flow? And, the first festival that we meet, maybe a bit surprising, is a weekly one. The weekly Sabbath, the seventh day. A day that's described as a day of rest. Do you appreciate how significant that was to these people? 6 months previously, they were relentlessly, ruthlessly worked 24/7. Pharaoh drove them. Work, work, work. God rescues them. He brings them to a place of rest, 1 in 7, to remind them that that is the destination he has for their lives. Rest. And it's a big idea in the scriptures, isn't it? So, we listen to Jesus as he speaks to people of his day who are just kind of, they're just crushed by the burden of this law that's applied to their life. They can't move. The weary, the laboring. Come to me, he says, all you who weary and labor, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. Now notice, will you, he does not invite you to find rest under his duvet, but under his yoke. We live just kind of at the back of Morton Hall, and it's easy to kind of walk out into the fields and then up onto the Braids. And in the fields, there are two Highland cattle who only ever wander about, eat grass, and get their photographs taken. Place a yoke on these beasts, and they become directable and useful. You move from the kind of empty life into a life of usefulness, significance. That's what the yoke of Jesus does in our lives. What is it brings about this rest in our lives? Well, you look at the next festival, and it is the Passover. The reminder that God has rescued his people by means of a sacrificial lamb whose blood was placed on the doorposts and meant that the destroyer did not enter their homes. Now, if you know the little letter of Peter at the end of the New Testament, you know that in that letter he says this: "For you know it was not with perishable things such as silver and gold that you were redeemed from the empty way of life." Do you hear that? Redeemed from the empty way of life, handed down to you by your ancestors, but by the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. Now you and I are like Israel in the sense that we are on the move. We are not stationary, and we're living in a wilderness world. That's our location, with lacks and difficulties and dangers and all kinds of pressures. That's where you and I live our lives. And you and I are going to be tempted to think that the empty way of life is actually the more fulfilling way than serving Jesus. And we're going to find ourselves asking this question: is this worth it? Is it really worth it to sacrifice to serve Jesus? Now, I'll put the question to you a slightly different way. Is there really a new heaven and a new earth? Is that true? As we get older and we think about the future, are you sure? Israel travels through the wilderness. They get to Kadesh Barnea, the border of the promised land. They look over into the promised land and they see well-fortified cities, big armies and strong people. And they say, no chance. God is not going to give us that land. Because they've forgotten what the Passover means. This God always, always, always keeps his promises. Yeah. That's what it said. And what is the thing that you and I need to allowed to weigh heavily on our hearts, when the empty life looks more attractive than serving Jesus, living on the wealth line or living on the intelligence line looks more attractive than living on the holiness line. Well, the only thing that will keep us going is to load your heart with the faithfulness of God to his promises. Because if God has kept his most costly promise, if when it came to the bit, and what stared him in the face was giving up his son for these sinful people, and he went through with it. He did not hold his hand back, but he crushed his much loved son. If the Lord would do that, there is no promise in the world that he will not keep. Load your heart with it. Load your heart with it. It is what will keep you going in this wilderness world as we make our way through it to the celestial city.